Welcome to the Seventh Row podcast. I am Maula Smith, one of the hosts of the podcast and the executive editor of Seventh Row. Seventh Row is a non-profit online film criticism publication and publishing house dedicated to helping viewers engage in political conversations through the lens of cinema. We're invested in how film can be a catalyst to help people understand and think about social structures and social change. On today's episode, we'll be paying tribute to a brilliant and influential filmmaker, Jeff Barnaby, who passed away in October at age 46. We've talked about Barnaby's work and the incredible influence he's had as an Indigenous storyteller working in the Canadian film industry a lot as a publication. We're huge fans, we've interviewed him, we placed his debut film, Rhyme Three on Ghouls, at the number 6 slot of our Best of the Decade list. We covered that film and his second feature, Blood Quantum, on this podcast. And as the collective of Seventh Row, we've been invested in talking about his career, and it was obvious to us that we had to have an in-depth discussion about his legacy when he passed away, and that we wanted to have one as well. But it's taken us a while to work out what that conversation should be, which is why it's taken a while for us to put this episode together. But we're having it now with this episode, and the hope is that we can celebrate his immense accomplishments, and also for people who are not aware of Barnaby and his work, let you know why he was so important and why he's someone you should pay attention to. Our bonus episodes, like this one, are usually members only, but we felt it was important to have this discussion on our main free podcast feed so that everyone could listen to it. If you want access to our other bonus episodes, you can become a member at seventh-row.com/join. That will also be in the show notes. The voices you'll hear in this episode are me, hello, my co-host Alex Heaney, the editor-in-chief of Seventh Row, and our associate editor, Brett Pardy. Here's the episode.
So today on the podcast, we are paying tribute to Mi'kmaq filmmaker Jeff Barnaby, who suddenly and sadly passed away from cancer on October 13th of 2022. We wanted to take some time to really think about how best to pay tribute to him, so that's why this is coming out a couple months later. Barnaby directed 2 feature films, Rhymes for Young Ghouls and Blood Quantum, and he had an enormous impact on the Canadian film industry and I think Indigenous filmmaking around the world. So we're going to talk about his films and his legacy and celebrate this artist who has gone too soon. I am Alex Heaney, editor-in-chief of Seventh Row. I am joined by my co-host, executive editor Orla Smith.
Hello.
And our guest, associate editor Brett Pardy.
Hello.
Yeah, it was such a huge shock to see that he had passed away.
Huge shock. Yeah.
Yeah. I was with a friend and I saw that it happened, and the friend hadn't heard of Jeff Barnaby, and I suddenly found myself like trying to explain just how important this guy was. Mm-hmm. And it was such a shock, and I was letting it sink in, and then kind of watching as particularly the Canadian press reacted, and kind of felt like very disappointed by how people, well, when I say people, again, I mean specifically the press.
Which we should say is basically the white settler press, although I don't know that APTN, which is the Aboriginal television network, did much better.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there were a lot of Indigenous filmmakers who had worked with him or knew him or had been influenced by him who had very heartfelt things to say about Jeff Barnaby's importance. But the sort of printed remembrances of him were kind of copied from the same press release. And it felt like people weren't really talking about just how influential this guy was, like how much he changed cinema. Like, he changed Canadian cinema. Certainly, he changed Indigenous cinema. He did really fascinating and innovative things with genre filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Like, he is someone who it takes... Like, I mean, we thought about writing something, and we were like, well, we've got to think, how would we write? How do we kind of reckon with his legacy? And then we realized that we can only kind of... Well, the best way to do it would be to do it, like, in a podcast episode where we could go long, because, like, it felt like that was the only way we could really talk about all the very complex ways that he was important, mm-hmm. and the complex things he did. Like, that... It takes a lot to reckon with that, and I felt like, you know, it's representative of what was so sad about, like, his career, that he never received the recognition and support that he needed and deserved, that his, you know, his death was not treated by the Canadian press with the gravity that it should have been.
I think also, like, you know, it's one thing to say a filmmaker's films changed filmmaking, and that's, you know, a big accomplishment, but I think he's one of the few filmmakers who can actually say that they affected social change. Mm. And I think that's a much rarer thing. I think for a lot of people, Rhymes for Young Ghouls was sort of a landmark film where it may have been the first time they encountered, you know, Indigenous storytelling. Kind of was for me. You know, I was an ignorant settler like the rest of us who, you know, I'd heard about, I vaguely knew that residential schools existed in the sense that, like, I had been told in one sentence in school in history class, you know, that we had them from, you know, the 1800s, and that they were starting to close in the 60s, and the last one closed in the 90s. But I'd had no idea what that really meant, and the fact that they were, like, sites of torture for children and genocide, and I didn't really know about all of that stuff. And I think I started, you know, the kind of amazing thing about Rhymes for Young Ghouls is it is such an emotionally impactful film, but it also raises so many questions. And if you're a settler and you aren't already educated, it makes you go, oh wow, there was a lot I didn't know.
There's actually reviews from 2013 of people suggesting the film is anachronistic, that to suggest that the Indigenous people knew about how bad the residential schools were at the time, because settlers didn't know about that at the time, so they assumed that, well, no one did, which is just shows the...
Oh my god.
I know, it's just mind-boggling to think that,
wow.
Like, to accuse the film of being anachronistic, but it just kind of shows how much settlers assumed residential schools had been buried.
Yeah, and it was... I mean, there's a lot to say about this film that I'm not going to sum up in the next 2 minutes, but I think it, like, for me personally, it kind of made me go, there's this whole part of Canadian history that I was not told about, that I did not know about, that I did not know to be curious about, and, you know, got me interested in, you know, looking for every Indigenous film that was made and doing my homework, which I think was part of what Jeff Barnaby wanted settlers to do when he saw his film, among other things, like, was that, you know, he was there to provoke, and it was our job to go and do the work.
Yeah, like, that's what is so great about his films, is that, and from his Twitter presence, you get the sense he clearly has no interest in this idea that he's out, that he has to, like, educate settlers.
No.
You know, he has to make films with a settler audience in mind, which is, unfortunately, is how a lot of Indigenous projects seem to get funded, especially over the last couple of years, as what's their kind of educational value.
Yeah.
Whereas Barnaby's films, you learn a lot because he's engaging, I think he's trying to get settler audiences in through the fact they're genre films. And then once you're intrigued by that, the hook's there, then he's going to actually get into, okay, yeah, this seems like a horror film, but that's because for Indigenous people, life has been a horror film in many ways, and I'm going to show how. And you can follow along and feel it, and then go want to learn more about it.
Yeah, and there's some kind of funny ironies to the fact that that's what happens, because he wrote the screenplay for Blood Quantum, I think, in 2010 or earlier, like well before Rhymes for Young Ghouls, and nobody wanted to make it. And he had to write the film that was about residential schools and make that first so that he could then make the crowd pleaser zombie film. And even then he could barely get the money, and it was, you know, it's a miracle that that film exists.
It shows you how bad the Canadian funding system is, that you can make Rhymes for Young Ghouls. It's like critically beloved, treated as this like landmark film, and then it's like
6 years, right?
We don't really want to fund another one of your films because,
yeah,
I don't know, we want kind of more oversight over what you're going to say.
Well, and also, I mean, he started making short films in 2004,
I think.
Four. And within film circles,
like he was on the Canadian Film Festival circuit.
Yeah, he was on the Canadian Film Festival circuit. And if you were in the know watching films made in Canada, then you knew he was a big deal. Because by the time I had become aware of Rhymes for Young Ghouls and started hearing it talked about, everybody who was in it was like, yeah, we've known he was a big deal for 10 years from his shorts. But then, like, what ended up happening with, you know, how his films got seen is, I think, Blood Quantum ended up drawing in a lot of audiences because it really was kind of a more pure genre film, and you could kind of not care about the issues it was talking about. You just want to see, like, a penis get cut off.
And I think it was on Shudder, which definitely helped.
Well, yeah, and also TIFF... You know, I give TIFF a lot of flack for doing a shitty job promoting Canadian cinema. They actually did their job with Blood Quantum. They gave Blood Quantum the opening night slot, and they programmed it in Midnight Madness. They really gave it a platform to find an audience, and they could have buried it the way they bury most films that are, you know, contractually obligated to program in order to get their funding from the Canadian government. But this was a really good thing that they did for the film. And I remember at TIFF that year, I was at the world premiere, and you know, I was kind of shocked to hear the film getting discussed on the Film Comment podcast. Like, they gave it a proper launch, which they don't do much, but at least they did do that. And I think that by giving it a proper launch inside, like, a, you know, a place for genre film lovers, that was instrumental in it getting a Shudder deal. And then the fact that it was on Shudder meant that it was available around the world, and, you know, it got buzz within the genre community, which is a pretty intense sort of, like...
Yes. And Blood Quantum has a really easy kind of pitch line.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you want to say what it is?
It's a film about where there's a zombie outbreak, but zombies only affect settlers and not Indigenous people. So the... People on an Indigenous reserve kind of create like this fortress against the settler zombies who are trying to get in.
Well, it's more like a zombie bite won't infect Indigenous people, but they can still eat you alive.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's still a threat, but you're not going to become a zombie yourself. You're just going to die, right. Which is bad.
So now, reserves become a place where the uninfected settlers want to escape to.
But I think Blood Quantum, then its popularity led people to go back and check out Rhymes for Young Ghouls.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, Jeff Barnaby was right that was a good film to make, to have made first. But Canadian funding bodies were not.
I'm kind of surprised the Canadian funding bodies went for Rhymes for Young Ghouls.
I know, I am too.
Like, I really want to know how that happened, because it just is not something that's not the sort of thing Canadian filmmaking likes.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as far as, like, in the history of Canada's truth and reconciliation attempts, claims, I don't know what to call it because we're doing a shitty job.
Wanting public praise for suggesting that we might do something someday.
Oh, that's the perfect distillation of it.
Maybe. But as long as it's the...
Yes, maybe. You know,
as long as we can still... As long as settlers can still feel good about it.
Oh, yeah.
Then, yeah, we'll do it. Maybe.
But so, I mean, in that context, we were talking before we started recording about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission reports, which were published in 2016. So Rhymes for Young Ghouls, you know, has in it a lot of things that settlers wouldn't have known about because they didn't become matters of, like, settler public record until 2016. And Rhymes was 2013, I believe. And the commission began in 2008. So they may have been at the point where they were like, oh, someone wants to make a film about residential schools. We should probably do that. And maybe didn't look that closely or quite understand. Or maybe they thought that it was a triumphant story because Ayla doesn't quite totally have to go to maybe they kind of got the through line. They're like, oh, this girl avoids residential school and she's plucky. And they're like, oh, cool. Sign me up. And they just kind of missed that the film was about how everyone was traumatized for generations and there was no way out.
I mean, it's also impressively cheap. It was only a budget of $1.5 million, which if you watched
How did he do that? You would never know that.
I managed to make that for $1.5 million Canadian.
I mean, he's working with relatively few locations. Like, you can see how, and there's not really many effects, which is probably why they were less likely to do Blood Quantum and more like, this can, like, we can pay you, like, no money to make this right and it will still, like, be possible.
Right.
There's still more effects than you would expect for $1.5 million
Yeah,
film.
There's
they have
there
an
are
animation
quite,
sequence.
There's an
animation. They have a hallucinatory dream.
I mean, the makeup budget must have been quite a bit because there's a lot of people getting beaten up and then with bruises and cuts and all of that.
I think the film is actually very economical in how it shows the violence, though, because it does.
Yes.
Because I showed this to a group largely of settler viewers once, and the place showing it was concerned that this was going to be, you know, too upsetting and too violent. But I was pointing out that, which seems like the whole point of it was we were looking at, you know, legacies of colonialism, which
is
kind of hard
not to be violent.
And like, there's no way you'd say Ron Strangles is like reveling in this violence.
It's handling
it about as responsibly as it can. That the only act of violence that we actually see fully in front of the camera is when, kind of at the end, when the Indian agent is shot. That most other acts of violence are implied, and it cuts away just before it happens.
Yeah. I mean, even Blood Quantum does that quite a bit, even though it does show some really graphic stuff. There's a lot of scenes where it's implied violence. But, I mean, I think it's interesting. Like,
there's nothing sadistic about Jeff Barnaby, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, as far as I'm aware, Rhymes for Young Ghouls was basically our first fiction film to deal with residential schools, which I should kind of put in quotes because they're called schools, but they were more like concentration camps for children.
I believe it was.
And, you know, now, because we're looking back at this almost a decade later, we can see what other films have been made about residential schools. And there's, like, Indian Horse, which you've seen, Brett. I mean, I've seen it too, but you have more articulate things to say about it than I do, Brett.
I mean, the scenes in residential school are designed very much to make white people cry, is how I would describe how residential schools are treated in Indian Horse. I mean, there's like a slow motion scene where a kid is locked in a cramped closet as a children's choir sings Ave Maria. It's a it's a heavy handed film. Well, Rhymes for Young Ghouls, I think, by saying that there's not much fun, it manages to make the scene where Isla's hair is cut off the most violent scene in
the
film.
I mean, I think it's still the most traumatic of the films. Like, as far as if you think about like a gut response that I had to Rhymes for Young Ghouls compared to like these other films, Rhymes for Young Ghouls hit me way harder, but he doesn't do it with gratuitous violence.
And what's scary about the nuns in it is they're not cackling evil. They're just like, they're not even human almost. They're just sort of there.
Yeah.
Like, just forcing people to do things, but they have no reaction to it at all, and that's terrifying.
I want to say, like, Brett, this is a film that you've chosen to teach quite a lot, right?
Yes.
And I think I'd be interested in hearing you talk about why.
I think it's that I like that it is trying to hit you on an emotional level first, and then you're going to, once you feel how things are, then you're interested in why things are that way. The film doesn't try and reverse that around. I really like the sequence where Isla is mixing a bunch of joints with different substances, and she talks about how there's this kind of the importance of forgetting within the community. I feel it kind of works to explain like kind of how not only the residential school system was bad, but the entire culture of the reserve is shattered because what used to be a communal thing is now the only way to survive is kind of taking advantage of someone else's desire to forget their trauma. Mm-hmm. And
to clarify for the listener, you're teaching it in the context of like how films create empathy.
Yes.
Which, if you haven't listened to our episode with Brett after his dissertation defense, he does have a PhD in how films do attempt to create empathy, I guess.
This was one of the three films that I wrote on in the dissertation. Largely because I was looking for particularly a film around Indigenous settler issues. And I was looking for a film that wasn't trying to didactically explain things. That's still a fairly limited pool of films, sadly.
Yeah. Well, especially when you were conducting your research, because that would have been...
That would have been about 4 years ago.
I mean, I feel like a lot's changed in 4 years. 4 years ago, we couldn't... There just weren't 10 Indigenous films being made that we could put on our top 10 lists.
Yes.
Because there weren't 10 of them. It wasn't even that, like, there weren't 10 great ones. There just weren't 10.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we made our list of the best films of the 2010s, this was Rhymes for Young Ghouls was our number 6, and Brett, you yelled at us that it wasn't high enough on the list, and I think you were right. I mean, Orla and I have had this discussion that we would have changed a lot of things on that list.
I mean, a ranking but I would've... is always very difficult. As long as it's in the top 10, I'm happy.
Yeah.
We need to go back to that list at some point.
Oh god, let's not open that can of worms.
I mean, it's one of those films I find kind of hard to talk about because I just like I like how the film kind of washes over you. Like, it's beautifully shot. It's edited in a really propelling, interesting way for the most part.
And it's just really good at, like, being a film that shows how these people have no good options. Like, even when there's, like, a triumphant defeat of the bad guys, it's still at the cost of, like, people's well-being in some way, whether that's, like, traumatizing in multiple different ways. So even things that might seem like temporary wins still don't solve things for the characters, but it is able to tell that very bleak story of trauma in this genre casing that still makes it even at times kind of entertaining. And I think he's someone who was very interested in like finding ways to tell very profound stories of colonial trauma in a way that was compelling to general audiences and to like bring those stories to a mainstream through the use of genre. And I think, you know, it's a real shame that we didn't get to see him become more prominent and bring those stories to even larger audiences. I mean, in an interview that you did with him, Alex, he talked about how he wanted to kind of like do a movie for every classic monster. Like he did his zombie movie, he wanted to do like a vampire movie and this kind of movie.
I can actually quote what he said.
He
says, "I've always been a hardcore horror fan. I almost feel like I have a classic monster trilogy in me about zombies, werewolves, and vampires. If I go to my grave having done a genre film with each one of those monsters, I die a happy man." Which is just like really depressing reading now.
Yeah, I mean, he did one, but you know, it's very sad to think about what we didn't get.
And he also talked about doing a cosmic horror film about the end of the world and someone trying to escape their fallen city to get home, which sounded interesting. So he had lots of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the miracles of Rhymes for Young Ghouls is it's a film that's full of ideas that also doesn't feel like a first draft. You know, like it is technically a first feature, And in no way are we ever talking about this film as though it's a first feature. I mean, he had made a few shorts that were pretty impressive, but he like launched into this as like a fully formed filmmaker. And for me, the film, I've seen it several times, and every time I watch it, I feel like I missed a third of what happened. And I don't think that I'm an unattentive viewer. I just think there's, you know, that's the mark of a great film, is that there is, you see new things every time you watch it. And I think especially as a settler, and thus, you know, fairly ignorant, every time I watch it, having learned more and gotten more context, there are more things in it that I get that went over my head. And I think, you know, what you were saying, Orla, like about how he shows the impacts of things that happen on the community, I think it's really a great film about systemic issues. While, like, it basically has this simple through line of the story is there's a teenage girl named Ayla. She is trying to stay out of residential school by bribing the truant officers, which she manages to get money for by having a drug business that she runs with her uncle. That's kind of, and you know, a big part of the plot hinges on the fact that her stash of money from her drugs gets stolen, and so is she going to be able to pay the guy in time to stay out of residential school? And a bunch of stuff happens. That's like the basic plot, but there's so many intricacies because it's a film about community, and everything that happens in it, you see the knock-on effects. Like, on the one hand, Ayla is kind of, you know, she's played by Devery Jacobs, who's incredibly charismatic. She's styled is very cool, and she's Devery Jacobs, so you root for her. And you're like, oh, she's found a way around the system. But it's like, yeah, but as Brett was saying, her solution to survive is that she provides, on the one hand, she's providing drugs to people to help them survive. On the other hand, she's part of the problem that's causing problems on the reserve. And, you know, part of her trauma stems from the fact that her mother died by suicide after accidentally running over her brother when her mother was drunk. And as she says in the film, that she aged 1,000 years the day
and her mom died. Dad decided to go to prison for that rather than actually face up to the trauma of that, having to raise his daughter by himself.
Right. Well, and the flip side of that is he also did, but at the same time, he also did that because Ayla was, like, technically in front of the wheel. Like, not that you should blame children for this, but he was also trying to protect his daughter. So, like, all of these things have multiple meanings and multiple resonances. You know, like, her uncle, who has been charged with taking care of her in the absence of her incarcerated father, is a snitch who gets paid by the Indian agents to snitch on the other indigenous people on the reserve and get them in trouble. And there's a scene early on in the film where you see this raid on a strip club where the Indian agents are beating up all of these indigenous people to a bloody pulp, and her uncle gets some cash in his pocket, and he stands by looking, you know, unhappy about what's going on. And then shortly after, there's a scene in which he gets beat to a bloody pulp by a bunch of other indigenous people for being a snitch. And somewhere percolating in the background is like, well, why is he a snitch? Is it really that he's profiting from it, or is this like part of his deal with the Indian agents to help keep Ayla out of residential school? Like, how much of this is for her benefit? Like, I don't think the film answers the question, but it raises it. Though I don't know that I caught that on the first viewings, but like, because Ayla thinks that she's paying off the Indian agent and that's how she's staying out. And I suspect there's a lot more going on behind the scenes that she's not aware of.
Yeah, he was a person who, like, I think he spoke a lot publicly on his Twitter mainly about how, you know, he was not short on ideas and how he felt that he was being, you know, excluded from a lot of opportunities, excluded from support, like support to make more films, to make films in the way that he wanted to. He was very, very open about how hostile he felt that the film industry was to him,
mm-hmm.
rightfully so. And I did have like weird feelings again about the way people talked about that, or the way they didn't talk about that when he died. I mean, he died very young. He was 46. So certainly, you know, a lot of the career he could have had was cut short. But at the same time, he started making films 18 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he made his first feature film almost a decade ago. We didn't, even if he had to die at age 46, we didn't need to only have two Jeff Barnaby feature films.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was ready to go, it seems. You know, he had all this potential in him, and
he could have made eight films in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and when we say, oh, it's such a shame he died so young, he could have made all these films. Actually, I think we should also say it's such a shame that the Canadian film industry prevented him from making all the films that he should have made while he was still alive, beyond the films that he would have made after he died.
And that they delayed him so much on the ones he did make. Because The Colony was, what, 2008?
Yeah, I think so.
And 2007, I think.
2007, okay. So that was...
That's a short film of his.
That's the film that everybody talked about as, like, you know, wow, this guy is a big deal. Yeah. And it took... So 6 years between that and when Rhymes for Young Ghouls was made, mm-hmm. like that's
he was a known quantity.
He was a known quantity, yeah, and hugely respected. He should have been able to make a feature.
And The well Colony like then. Establishes the kind of genre star that he would then go on to work
in. Yeah,
like, you know, he made it clear what he wanted to say, and I think it's great to celebrate the films he made, but also like let's not forget how much of a toll they took on him. Like, he would often on Twitter talk about how he was thinking about giving up because it was just, it took so much out of him to try to, like, make it by as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And that's partly because, like, he wasn't being given opportunities, and partly also because his films were so low budget and just not given, like, the resources and support they needed. He had to, you know, wear so many hats. Like, I think you asked him at one point, Alex, like, why, you know, he liked to direct, write, compose, and edit his films. Like, he composed the music for them as well. He edited them. And his answer was basically, like, well, because we didn't really have the money to pay someone else to do it.
Yeah.
And he's very good at those things, certainly. Mm-hmm. But you don't always want to, like, break your back, like, not get any sleep trying to do the jobs of 10 different people.
Yeah.
And there's a quote from the interview that you did with him on Blood Quantum that I find really sad. That's at the very end of the interview, which I'll just read in full. He says, "Where it becomes exhausting and frustrating is that you wanted things a certain way and you realize it would have worked a certain way, and you lament having left that on the page or left it on set. With Blood Quantum, because of time and money issues, I've never experienced more loss from script to screen than I have with this film. So that's really, at the end of the day, what exhausts you. Not the physical labor or the mental labor, because if you're doing this, you love it. It's not what you want. It's not getting what you want and realizing it months after, years after in this case. I just watched it this morning, and all I noticed were the fucking mistakes. You can't appreciate your own work on that level. That's where it becomes taxing." And I love that he was very upfront about saying that, even when mm-hmm. promoting his own film.
Yeah.
He was like, watching this film is painful for me because I didn't get to make it the way that I wanted to, mm-hmm. and it took so much out of me. And I think he was important as a filmmaker because of the films he made, but also because of the way that he wasn't afraid to say that, like, he shouldn't have had to make them in the way that he did.
Yeah.
And I think we should talk about that more around his death, because clearly, based on the way that he talked about his own work, that's a message that he wanted out there about his films and about his experience in the industry.
Yeah, I think when he said that to us, that changed a lot how we looked at Indigenous films, because we became really aware of the budgeting constraints. Because I think when we review and discuss Indigenous films, we always talk about the caveat of how they weren't allowed to make the film that they wanted to make. And that there's different, you can't quite judge it on the same standard as a film that is allowed to achieve its potential. And that you can see that a lot happening in Indigenous films that are made in Canada. And, you know, he's not the only filmmaker to lament this.
More ideas than there is budget.
And I think there's huge ambition, right? You know, Loretta Todd, who made Monkey Beach, said you can't survive colonialism and not be epic. And I think there's a lot of desire to make these big epic stories for good reason. And, you know, it's kind of a miracle that, like, Rhymes for Young Ghouls is that. And I don't know how he made it on the tiny budget he had. You know, we've had lots of great films that have been made on not on shoestring budgets, but you also can feel how much was probably left on the page. And then you can also get told that by the filmmaker.
And it's so rare in a world where, at the moment, where everyone is so over-the-top promotional, to be that honest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what was cool about his Twitter account, because like artists are always using their social media as just endless kind of hype for themselves, and he was just always so regular and honest about what he was into, what he was thinking on his Twitter. It was, I can't think of many filmmakers like that.
Yeah. And the way that, like, you could actually see the complexities and the contradictions there, like, because he died a couple weeks before the Imaginative Film Festival happened this year. And so I was going back, and because I'd remembered he'd said a lot of things about Imaginative through the years. And of course, I was thinking about him and his legacy as Imaginative rolled around. And I was looking back at his tweets. And it's, you know, if you search Jeff Barnaby in Imaginative, you see tweets that say everything from, you know, like, you want to see films by women, go to Imaginative. It's great. And, you know, what a great screening we had. And, oh, they're doing this thing with Devery. And, you know, like laudatory things about them. And then at the same time, you also have tweets where he talks about how when Rhymes for Young Ghouls screened at Imaginative, it got a standing ovation, but it lost the award to Satellite. Well, he didn't say this, he said to a white woman, but if you look it up, it was Satellite Boy, which is actually a David Gopalil feature. He's in that film. It was made by a white woman, Australian film, and he actually quotes one of the jurors in one of his tweets about how they said that they felt that Rhymes for Young Ghouls was too bleak, basically, something like that.
Mm. Which is, of course, exactly when you're running an Indigenous film festival, what you should be what you should be concerned about.
Yeah. Mm. He felt hard done by a lot of organizations that were supposed to uplift Indigenous people for good reason. And, you know, that made him somewhat of a controversial figure, because he had really strong opinions about how Indigenous films should be made by Indigenous people, not just have some Indigenous people in the cast or have an Indigenous script editor who okays a script written by a white person.
Which, when you say that out loud, doesn't really sound that controversial.
No, I know, but like...
it was treated like law.
He got heat for that, you know, and he told people, he said this stuff face-to-face to people in power, and they blacklisted him.
I know, how dare an artist have integrity?
I know, right?
And it's worth saying that, like, he was just someone who definitely just, who wasn't just in it for himself. Like, he was very passionate about, like, Indigenous cinema as a whole, and did things like, I mean, his support of Devery Jacobs was unwavering. And he even, when she moved into filmmaking, making shorts, produced some of her shorts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he fought for her to be in Rhymes for Young Ghouls. When I interviewed Devery, she actually told this story about, like, they really didn't want to let her star in this film because she was an unknown quantity, and Jeff really believed in her, and he like, really fought for her. And, of course, she was the perfect person to star in the film. And the film launched her career. And she herself has, you know, has not gotten, you know, I mean, she's becoming a star now. But
it's taken too long.
It's been 10 years. Like, where are all the starring roles she should have had in the last decade?
I mean, yeah, that's another thing where it's like, you know, we can celebrate that Devery Jacobs is, you know, getting nominated for awards now and winning awards. But, like, let's also talk about, like, how, you know, if she was, like, a white settler, she would have been, like, super famous right after Rhymes for Young Girls.
Yeah. One, I think also it's, you know, something that she had said to me. I'm paraphrasing here. Maybe I should look it up. You know, before Rhymes for Young Ghouls, she'd just never seen anybody who looked like her in a film on screen. And she felt like there was no space for her in the film industry. And then she met Jeff Barnaby and got to make Rhymes for Young Ghouls. And suddenly she felt like maybe there was a place for her in the industry. And of course, in the next few years was a lot of people telling her that there wasn't space for her. Until, you know, she started to find some footholds and the world started to change.
And she, you know, she's been in a lot of Indigenous films lately that arguably, like, are getting made now because of the influence of someone like Jeff Barnaby.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he helped create an environment in which someone like Devery Jacobs could have a career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even the idea that we have this whole genre of, like, Indigenous genre films. We didn't have enough Indigenous fiction films before that you could even say that existed as a genre. But now we have Night Raiders and Monkey Beach and Jeff Barnaby's films in Canada. There's others in other countries as well. And we've talked about Jeff Barnaby having a Twitter presence that was, you know, influential and important. But we haven't really talked about the fact that he also was, like, a very accessible person on Twitter. Like, he acted like a regular guy, which a lot of filmmakers don't, even if they are regular guys. And, I mean, I guess I'm the only one who's actually interacted with Jeff Barnaby on Twitter. I mean, I didn't do it very much, but I met him on Twitter before I had seen Rhymes for Young Ghouls because I was tweeting it about how I wanted to see the film and somebody was, but I was living in the States at the time and where can I find it? And somebody tagged him in and he told me how I was going to be able to see his film, which is kind of wild. And, you know, he was pretty generous. Like, you followed him, he'd follow you. And then, like, I know he read some of my tweets because he responded to them. I know he listened to our episode on his films because he tweeted at us about it.
Which is honestly a bit nerve-wracking.
It was very nerve-wracking. I might have thought about it a little differently if I'd known he was going to be listening to it. You kind of expect these things to go out into the void, and then when directors actually listen to your podcast on their film, you freak the hell out.
Yeah, has happened a few times.
It has, yeah. Yeah, so I think, I mean, he was kind of he's just a very generous presence. I mean, he also was kind of an angry presence, you know, justifiably so. But
he talked about his anger at the world and the unfairness of the world and the film industry as well a lot. And I think that's something he was very passionate about, using Twitter as a platform for.
Yeah, but he was also, like, just, like, a film Twitter guy in a way. Like, yeah. You know, like, a couple times I posted questions about, like, what are movies about blah, or what are your favorite movies like blah, and, you know, he responded to them like a like a human.
Yeah, and he was very funny on Twitter at times as well.
And, you know, like, I mean, my experience was, you know, once I really put my foot in it and he reached out to me and DM'd me and helped me not do that again and try and crawl my way out of there, which was a very generous thing for him to do and did not have to do in my senses. That was just something that he did. Like, it wasn't I'm not alone. I mean, Brett, I don't know if you want to mention this, but you were saying that you knew somebody who reached out to him who was doing work on...
Yeah, one of my colleagues was putting together an Indigenous film class, and she's Indigenous from New Zealand and was looking for Canadian films, and she was talking to Jeff Barnaby on Twitter, and then they were DMing about ideas for the class, and that was just in September, like a month and a half before he died.
Mm.
Like, it's amazing he was taking the time to help shape that class.
Yeah, I mean, I think he really cared about these things, so I think if you've reached out to him and he knew you cared, he would talk to you.
Yeah, it wasn't just posturing. He would do these things privately and do work that, again, he didn't need to do, but he felt very passionate about. And I think he, you know, probably has no idea just how much, like, that conversation you had with him in DMs had just affected the way we, like, interviewed Indigenous filmmakers from then on.
Yeah.
He... just as you said, his talking openly about how difficult it has been to make his films on such a low budget has influenced the way we think about Indigenous film. He's also influenced our reporting when talking to Indigenous filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
Just from sort of small but important acts of putting himself out there to tell people when they're wrong.
And he's one of the only people who's really talking about, you know, what it was like to work in the Canadian film industry as an Indigenous person. There was a lot of inside baseball stuff, you know, including his both praise and complaints about Imaginative. That was a real insight. And, you know, it feels like not only have we lost a great filmmaker and changer and, you know, person who is uplifting other Indigenous people, we've also lost a huge, I mean, I don't know how much he talked about this to how many people know, but, like, he was a huge resource as far as understanding the history of Indigenous filmmaking, fiction filmmaking in Canada, and what that scene was like. He knew it in a way other people didn't, because he was there first and because he was willing to talk about it. And now we've lost that whole body of knowledge. You know, there's snippets that are left. There's his Twitter account. There's what he told other people. So, you know, we have little bits and pieces, but that feels like a huge cultural memory loss.
And you know, we've published one really great interview with him on Seventh Row, but I think we always had, like, sort of in the back of our head, like, this idea that, like, oh, it would be great to sort of, if he was willing, do longer profiles with Jeff Barnaby.
Yeah.
Like, someone that, like, when you pick his brain, he has so much to say. He's so fascinating and he's so passionate about what he says. Like, it felt like, of course, like, in the future, we'll, like, publish a long profile or multiple with Jeff Barnaby. And now to realize that, like, that knowledge won't be imparted anymore is very sad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I interviewed him, I kind of thought that was the first of many interviews that I hope to do, to hear what he had to say about so many things. And
because I don't think there are a ton of sort of very in-depth, lengthy profiles of him or interviews of going in deep about any of his specific films and filmmaking. And they would have been good if the one we did with him was any indication.
Yeah.
Well, they would have had a lot of swears in them and I would have enjoyed it a lot.
Well, there aren't a lot of people who care about cinema that's made in Canada. Viewers still who care about Indigenous cinema. You know, I was recently looking through the profiles of, like, grad students in film studies across most of the major Canadian universities where I was aware they had film studies programs, and there are zero people working on contemporary Canadian cinema, let alone Indigenous cinema. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't look everywhere. Where did I look? I looked at McGill. I looked at SFU. I looked at UBC, U of T, Concordia, Ottawa.
No, you've covered all the main ones.
Yeah, I think I looked at Dalhousie or somewhere out east, and I couldn't believe that nobody was working on this, because I thought I want to find,
like, one, like, per program.
There's got to be, like, a grad student somewhere, right? Like, or who's working on Indigenous film in Canada, or even just Canadian film. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't believe it. And anybody who said they might, there were some people who said they were, like, interested in Indigenous film, but they, you know, they weren't doing anything about it. I'd look and see their advisors, and their advisors weren't publishing on that either. So, like, that's a pretty depressing state of affairs. And then when you look at, you know, who covers this stuff, like, to my knowledge, there is one person in Canada who is Indigenous and writes about film, and she's not a film critic. She's a journalist who occasionally writes about film and programs film. And so what, it's left to the Settler Press, and most people, you know, the publications don't want to publish it because it's not going to move hits, or just don't care. And, you know, as you can tell from the reviews of Ransford and Gules that you were talking about, Brett, like, there aren't a lot of people, you know, are there people who can ask him the right questions because they are informed? And I'm not saying I'm that person, but I'm more informed than really, really depressingly what it seems to be most people out there. Like, I was really hoping that I could find somebody who was, like, the academic in this, you know?
I mean, I think we've tried very hard to approach writing about Indigenous film and interviewing Indigenous filmmakers in the right way, and that's been a long learning process.
Yeah.
But the ideal situation would be that, like, there would be an infrastructure in place where, like, there were Indigenous film critics with that specialty who were being supported by, like, major publishing institutions who could do that work themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And that we could, you know, maybe do some work that they don't want to do about communicating to settlers. But
yeah, we will continue to try our best with this stuff. And I think do better than some of the settler news media and film media in Canada. But, like, you know,
we're gonna make mistakes because that's what happens.
And Jeff Barnaby can't correct us anymore in the way that he did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to know what you don't know and what we're losing out on because those perspectives don't exist.
Yeah.
At least in publishing, in major publishing.
So we've talked a lot about Jeff Barnaby's feature films, Rhymes for Young Ghouls and Blood Quantum, and, you know, the films he didn't get to make and now will not get to make. But I think one of the things that is still a discovery for many people, and was a discovery for me actually finding these as we were preparing for this episode, are his short films, which, you know, they are actually out there and available, and I think we'd recommend checking them all out. Brett, you had some thoughtful things to say about his first short from Cherry English.
Yeah, I think all of his films actually have really strong moments of using horror imagery as a way to communicate kind of Indigenous history and the traumatic violence that's occurred to them. Like in From Cherry English, there's a scene where when an Indigenous man is asked to say something in his language and is like, I don't know anything in my language.
Then, well, it's later, a white person, so actually she says in Indian.
Yes. And then there's a scene where his tongue literally comes out of his mouth and then trying to jam it back in. Mm-hmm. So that's a very interesting visual metaphor for losing a language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and The Colony has some intense chainsaw action.
Oh my god.
And cockroach action.
Oh, yes. And then he also made a short for the National Film Board where he was editing together. It's called Bleed Down.
Which is definitely my favorite of them.
Yeah, yes, it's my really favorite brilliant. Too.
Because even though he's just selecting archival imagery, it comes across as this really chilling horror film the way he edits it together. And the music and the pacing, and it also shows you the callousness of some of the things that were filmed and put in the archives.
Bleed Down is part of a series of short films that were commissioned by the National Film Board from Indigenous filmmakers, or who were then thought to be Indigenous. Michelle Latimer is one of them. But including Jeff Barnaby and also Carolyn Monet, where they were asked to work with archival footage to make a 5-minute short film. I've seen Carolyn Monet's film, and it's kind of a little miracle because it looks exactly like her other shorts. Like all of the, she picks the same kind of images as you see in her other shorts. It feels exactly like a Carolyn Monet film. And then here with Bleed Down, you have Jeff Barnaby, and it's like the same, you know, as Brett said, it's like a horror film and a really angry one about the horrors of colonialism. And, you know, he takes this footage that was produced by a colonialist organization made by settlers, I'm sure shot through an extremely colonialist lens, and takes it and uses it to expose the horrors of colonialism in a way that only Jeff Barnaby can. I think something we didn't talk too much about, but I think is, I'll mention now, is he's, you know, he has edited all his films, and he's a really great editor, and you really see that in Bleed Down. I think it's, you know, if you really want to see what, how much a filmmaker put their stamp on archival material by the way they edit it, Souvenir is a great series for that, and Jeff Barnaby's film is, I think, a really strong indicator of that. So we will put in the show notes links to all of his films, which fortunately are all available worldwide. You could even just download The Colony off of Vimeo. They're all free to watch online. And something that Jeff Barnaby talked a lot about with Blood Quantum was how influenced he was by the Anishinaabe filmmaker Alanis Obomsawin, who has made some real landmark documentaries for the National Film Board here in Canada. And I'm sure he would want people to be checking out those films, who were admirers of his films and want somewhere further to look.
Thank you so much for listening. Again, we implore you to seek out Barnaby's work, and we'll include information on how to find it in the show notes. If you do watch his films, please let us know about it, and please share them with other people. We've talked about Barnaby on this podcast before in episodes that are now members only. Those would be episode 39 on Rhymes for Young Ghouls, and Blood Quantum, and our two-part series on Indigenous YA, which is episodes 62 and 63. You can become a member at 7th-row.com/join. Also, we did an episode that's free to the public that we mention in this episode, which is our bonus episode number 27. In which we talked to Brett about his PhD on empathy in film. And he, one of the key texts that he discusses in his PhD is Rhymes for Young Ghouls. So we talk about that film in that context there as well. So I will link that in the show notes for you. We will also link in the show notes to our on-site written interview with Barnaby, which was quoted in this episode. I really recommend reading it. His insights and his passion are incredibly compelling. If you enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to let us know. You can email us at contact@7th-row.com or tweet at us all at 7th row, SEVENTHROW. It's the same on Instagram. But the best way to tell us what you think of the pod is by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. It helps a ton and always makes our day. We'll see you next time.